The year 1813 was a very important year in the world of opera, although no one knew it at the time. Near the town of Busseto in northern Italy, the composer Giuseppe Verdi was born. And in that same year of 1813, 600 miles to the north in the city of Leipzig, Germany, the composer Richard Wagner was born. These two composers, Verdi and Wagner, would come of age and go on to dominate the 19th century opera world. And whether or not you're aware of it, you probably know some of their music. For instance, Verdi wrote this.
La donna è mobile, qual più al vento.
And this. And you know Wagner from this. And this. Both composers wrote some of the most famous music of all time. They also became icons of their nations during turbulent eras, Verdi for Italy and Wagner for Germany. Their music still moves us, and their operas still play to packed houses around the world. But these two composers were, in many ways, opposites. And in this hour, we'll explore those crucial differences. We'll examine their music, we'll look at their place in history, and we'll ask what it is they valued most. From WQXR Radio in New York, this is The Clash of the Titans, an exploration of Verdi and Wagner. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. I'll be your host as we delve into the legacies these two musical giants left us. So what are the differences between Verdi and Wagner? Our program is called Clash of the Titans, but what's the clash? It's not a personal clash. The two composers never met, although they were well aware of each other's reputation. Verdi was impressed by Wagner's musical skill, and Wagner was jealous of Verdi's popularity. No, what we're referring to are fundamental differences on a more profound level, and it's those that interest us here. Although Verdi and Wagner are the two most famous opera composers of the 19th century, they could not be more different. What we're going to do is take an element of Verdi, look at it in depth, and then look at the same element in depth for Wagner. We'll go back and forth between the two, and by the end of our program, we'll see how these two men of music, both born in the same year, but flowering in completely different directions, ultimately empowered both the greatest and the worst sides of humanity. So, for our opening comparison, let's start with the basics, the operas. We've invited two scholars to assist us.
I'm Gundula Kreutzer. I'm a musicologist at Yale University, and I work on both Verdi and Wagner.
My name is Robert Greenberg. I am music historian in residence for San Francisco Performances and a composer as well.
Let's start with Verdi. Where did Verdi get the stories for his operas?
He read a lot. And that's reflected in the fairly high literary standards of the pieces he wrote. He really did like setting libretti that were by real authors that told real stories.
Authors such as Victor Hugo, Lord Byron, Schiller, Voltaire, and Alexandre Dumas Jr. Oh, and one other guy.
Verdi wrote Shakespeare operas. He wrote three great Shakespeare operas. In fact, the three greatest Shakespeare operas ever written.
The first, Macbeth, written in 1847, revised in 1866. Sometimes it's Lady Macbeth who gets top billing in this opera. The second, Othello, which becomes, in Italian, Otello, premiered in 1887. Verdi's third Shakespeare opera is based on The Merry Wives of Windsor and Henry IV. It's Falstaff, premiered in 1893.
I think on the level of plot, we could say that many of his operas deal with really essentially human conflicts or human issues, psychological issues, unhappy love, or lovers who are not allowed to get married because of social conventions, conflicts between daughters and fathers. There's a lot of father-daughter relationships. So those are conflicts that we can associate with and that he captures very emotionally in very beautiful music.
Let's take that apart and start with unhappy love. We can see this in La Traviata of 1853, the story of Violetta, the famous courtesan who falls in love with Alfredo. But the romance goes against the conventions of the time. As for father-daughter relationships, we can see this in Simon Boccanegra, written in 1857 and revised in 1881, based on the real life story of the first Duke of Genoa and his daughter Amelia. And in Aida from 1871, we have a pair of fathers and daughters, the king of Egypt and his daughter, and the king of Ethiopia and his daughter, who is Aida. Both daughters are in love with the same tenor. We'll let you guess which daughter he prefers.
Verdi's roots always lay in popular art. That was the nature of his industry. A popular art always has its roots in song.
La donna è mobile, qual più al vento.
So Verdi is not an experimental composer. When he needs to underpin La donna è mobile, it's a pop song. And he's going to give it a pop song setting. And it's going to be the song everyone's going to sing coming out of the opera. And it's the one they're all going to buy sheet music for the next day when they can. Verdi is coming out of a long and profitable industry, the Italian opera industry. Like the television industry or the sports industry in our world today, opera was the entertainment, the most important entertainment of Verdi's time. It was the only place where you could experience other realities, the opera house. Let's face it, pre-electronics, you had to go somewhere, and you had to go somewhere that would become an alternative reality. So Verdi came up in an industry, a very profitable industry. And, you know, one of the things when you're making a lot of money, you don't mess with what works. And what worked was certain kinds of stories that would amuse a certain kind of singing style, something called the bel canto style, because everyone in Italy loves beautiful voices and beautiful songs.
In terms of music dramatic structure, he is based very much on the conventions that his predecessors left him in Italian opera. And so we can actually take apart his operas very much by scene types. And even though throughout his career he tried to transgress these conventions and adjust them to each individual moment of his dramas and the psychology of each character, and it's very beautiful in the ways in which he does that, and we can see that each time that he tweaks a convention, it is in order to be very expressive. But even though he does that, we can see those formal conventions all the way down to Otello, where we still have the introductory chorus and we still have the famous love duet at the end of Act One. We still have these so-called set pieces and individual numbers. So it is much more structured than Wagner's operas would be.
So now let's look at Wagner's operas. Wagner is a totally different beast from Verdi. Wagner was a musical revolutionary, and everything he did went against the conventions of the time.
So Wagner, unlike Verdi, wrote his own libretti. He chose his own subject matter and then crafted his own libretti. And those libretti are very idiosyncratic.
Wagner published his libretti, the stories of the opera, even before he set the operas to music.
And that was absolutely unusual in Italian operatic practice. He would not have done this because somebody else could have taken the libretto and set it to music. With Wagner, it was different. He wrote his own libretti, and they were thought to be so crazy that no other composer would have dared.
These crazy libretti show a major contrast between Verdi and Wagner. Verdi's operas are stories about people. Well, not Wagner's. Sure, there are people in his operas, but most of them aren't like us.
The stories of Wagner's operas are all mythological analogs. People are more often than not tools of higher forces, very often supernatural forces. Human emotions become stylized, they become archetypes rather than something we can immediately identify with as we would with Italian opera.
Wagner took old medieval German stories, updated them, and made them more relevant.
He didn't make up the myths, but he often mixed various sources. He even mixes characters, puts characters from one into the other, and fuses them. But the elements, all of them, go back to myth.
What he's trying to do is create a mythological environment in which contemporary issues can be stated and dealt with and observed, but through the lens of myth, which makes them eternal.
For example, Lohengrin, completed in 1848, is the story of a knight who rescues a maiden on the condition that she never ask his name. It's based on German stories about King Arthur. Many of Wagner's operas have love stories, but they're a lot more sexually explicit than other composers of the time.
So if you think of an opera like Tannhäuser, which is all about sexual lust, Venus versus a more established, more mature relationship with Elizabeth.
In Tannhäuser, which Wagner finished in 1845, the lead character must decide between sensual love and sacred love. The nurturing of the body versus the nurturing of the soul. Then, in 1859, Wagner completes Tristan und Isolde, which takes the idea much further.
Tristan, of course, is all about an illegitimate love and the desire for union that's not allowed, and the whole opera is a yearning for that union.
And then there is The Ring of the Nibelung, an unprecedented cycle of four operas completed in 1872.
People said he can never pull this off. Which opera house would be willing to commit to four operas rather than just one? And Wagner, of course, said he only wants to have them performed all four together. And that was a huge financial risk.
The Ring was so gigantic in size and scope that ultimately a special theater would be built in Bayreuth, Germany, in order to put it on. The sprawling story of these four operas details the lives of the gods, most notably Wotan, his daughter Brunhilde, and the hero she falls for, Siegfried. So, in Verdi operas, people. In Wagner, mythical people, archetypes. A couple of other things make Wagner operas different from Verdi's.
On the musical level, of course, I think one thing that many people would say is, oh, they're so long, these operas are so long. And they don't fall easily into these individual numbers that we have in Verdi. In fact, it was his idea to completely compose out the drama, without the music being dominant and structuring individual pieces.
And for this reason, Wagner didn't want his compositions to be called operas. He insisted they be called music dramas.
And so what we get increasingly in Wagner is that the orchestra takes over. The orchestra is the dominant musical element. and plays continuously, and the vocal lines are inserted into the orchestra fabric, almost as if the voices were yet another instrument. And that is very distinct from Verdi, where the singer is very important and the arias and later the duets are very important and the solo singer really stands out.
And so we see the fundamental differences. Verdi was accepting of the conventions of his time, slowly evolving and bettering them. Wagner rejected the operatic world of his day and instead set out to revolutionize it, to create something totally new. You're listening to The Clash of the Titans, an exploration of Verdi and Wagner. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. We'll be back with more in a minute. Stay with us. You're listening to The Clash of the Titans, an exploration of Verdi and Wagner. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. We've examined the operas. Now we're going to broaden the investigation and look at the impact their music had on European history. Both men were bigger than opera. They became national icons, and their music played important roles in the history of Italy and Germany. But the history of those countries is very different, and their place within those histories is vastly different. So we're going to add one more person to our cast.
I'm Jonathan Steinberg. I'm the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of Modern European History at the University of Pennsylvania.
We'll begin with Verdi. For many, the music of Verdi has a singular message, Glorious Italia. But we have to remember, during much of Verdi's time, Verdi was born in 1813, Italy as we know it today did not exist.
When Verdi started composing, Italy was divided into lots of small states and a couple of big ones. There was the Kingdom of Piedmont in the north, which was not really an Italian state at all. The people spoke either French and Piedmontese, which is not Italian. There was the provinces of Lombardy and Venetia, which were directly under the Austrians. And the Austrians had concentration camps, in effect, big fortresses in which you would be put if you were caught passing secretly stuff about Italian unification. The Kingdom of Naples and the Two Sicilies was probably the most reactionary and most corrupt state in Europe. The Pope ruled most of central Italy, and the popes between 1815 and 1846 were hardly what you would call revolutionaries. Gregory XVI refused to have gas lights in the Papal States because if there were gas lights, people might walk around at night and spread seditious ideas. And the idea of a railroad in the Papal State was even worse because he called it le chemin d'enfer, the road to hell. So no railroads, because if there were railroads, people would go around and spread seditious ideas. And so that's the kind of world in which Verdi began his career. Everything was censored, everything was tricky, but music is music, and the Italians like it, and as long as he kept just on this side of the law, he was okay. So what Verdi did with his operas, especially Nabucco, which is his first big success, was to express the longing of this tiny bourgeoisie for national unity, for an end to the humiliations, for an end to foreign occupation. And so a lot of what he was doing was coded.
By coded, Jonathan Steinberg means that there were messages hidden inside the opera. In Verdi's operas of the 1840s, that coding was in the backdrop. He had the love story and emotional conflicts we've come to expect from him in the foreground. But in the background, there would frequently be a conflict of repression or domination that had to be overcome. It starts with Nabucco, the biblical story of Nebuchadnezzar, premiered in 1842.
So the story is about the captivity of the Israelis, of the Hebrews, by the Babylonians. And at the time, northern Italy was dominated by Austria. And so the idea of one people being dominated by another country really resonated.
Nabucco contains the chorus Va Pensiero, where the assembled Hebrews sing of their thirst for freedom. The full title translates as Fly Thoughts on Golden Wings. This has been proposed time and again for Italy's national anthem, and it played a huge part in the Italian nationalist movement during Verdi's life. Once Nabucco was successful, that's where the Italian operatic industry comes in.
Just like Hollywood movie makers today, you have a movie that's successful and so you do a sequel. Back then it wasn't quite a sequel, but Verdi liked the idea of doing some operas that work along similar lines. Two warring countries and a lover's couple caught between those two countries.
And we see this in his next opera, in 1843, I Lombardi alla Prima Crociata, The Lombards at the First Crusade. We have the love story. The opera is the story of Italian crusaders and pilgrims reclaiming Jerusalem, taking back the Holy Land. We also have a famous chorus here, even bigger than Va Pensiero when it first premiered. And then in 1846, Verdi wrote Attila, about Attila the Hun, who tries to conquer Italy, but the Italians are able to gain victory. Again, we hear Verdi's longing for a free Italy in the music itself. In one famous line, the Roman general says to Attila, "You will have the universe. Leave Italy for me." And finally, we have La Battaglia di Legnano, or The Battle of Legnano, from 1849, about a battle that actually took place in 1176 when a German emperor tried to subjugate Italy. This opera had huge resonance in Verdi's day because we actually have Italians against Germans within the story. We have the now familiar lovers, of course. And a patriotic chorus that's hard to miss. Viva Italia! By putting these elements into his operas, Verdi became strongly associated with something called the Risorgimento.
The Risorgimento was a cultural movement beginning in the 1840s against the foreign occupation of the Austrians after 1815. To revive, it means in Italian, resurgence. But the resurgence of what? Of the culture of Dante, Petrarch, and Boccaccio, of Italian glory, of Italian history, of Italian unity. The only problem was there was no Italian language. That is to say, there was a great classical Italian language, but nobody really spoke it. Or very few spoke it. The church spoke it and some intellectuals. So what had to happen was that the language had to be reinvented. So what do? You go to the greatest period of Italian history, which is the period of the Florentine Renaissance, Dante, Petrarch, and Boccaccio, and you use that language to create a modern language. And that is precisely what Alessandro Manzoni did. He went to Florence with a notebook, and he took down what people in the street were actually saying, Florentine dialect, and he converted that into Italian. And he wrote a novel called I Promessi Sposi, because in a novel you have to have words for things like knife and fork and table, and all of those things were in dialect. So he invented, in effect, modern Italian.
Manzoni's novel, I Promessi Sposi, which is translated as The Betrothed, is one of the most famous works of Italian literature, and it displays many of the same themes as Verdi's operas in the 1840s, a great love story set against a backdrop of Italy under the rule of a foreign regime in a different time period. Manzoni, like Verdi, was an artist who preconditioned the Italian population to take control of their own destiny.
And Verdi admired him enormously. See, you could write poetry in Italian, you could write philosophy in Italian, but you couldn't go shopping in Italian because everybody spoke dialect. And you had to have a national language to have a national people. So the Risorgimento was a resurgence of Italian culture. It was the revival of, or in fact, the reinvention of, a new national language. That's what the Greeks did. They tried to speak the language of Plato, but the people continued to speak Demotic and speak that today. But Italian took off, and it actually eventually did become the national language many years later.
For historian Jonathan Steinberg, the music, the plots, even the patriotic undertone of Verdi's operas are not the big deal.
I think the most important thing about them was that they were in Italian. And Italian was an artificial language not spoken by the people. But it was the symbolic language of unification. Bear in mind that in the typical small Italian town, the one thing they did have was an opera house. Everyone had an opera house. So there was music
in the place of politics, and that music was patriotic, it was in Italian, and the audience understood the cues. So Verdi's role as a kind of propagandist is very great.
Wait a minute. If no one in Italy spoke Italian, and Verdi's operas are in Italian, how did audiences understand them?
It was their language ideally. It's exactly like the story of modern Hebrew. When Eliezer ben Yehuda decided to invent modern Hebrew, he's got to find some form of Hebrew to use as his basis. Same was true in Lithuanian. The same was true in Slovak. You have to find some idiom which you create as the 19th century's version of the language. That's not unique to Italy. It's just that nobody thinks of Italy as a backward Eastern European country the way you think of Slovakia, Slovenia. Italy was economically and socially backward, with 75% illiteracy, peasant agriculture, the lowest number of engines of any one of the major European countries, really, really backward. Italy, which the people of the Risorgimento imagined, was not there. It had to be created.
And there were several attempts. In 1848, the Piedmontese tried to liberate and unite Italy by fighting the Austrians, but they lost.
Cavour came to power after that, and he saw that the only way to unify Italy was with outside aid. And he eventually convinced Napoleon III to join him in a war against Austria, and that's what made Italian unification possible. The French beat the Austrians removed their troops from most of northern Italy, there were plebiscites, and Italy was unified. So in that context, you can see how this music, with its patriotic undertone, and he was often censored, by the way. It's not the case that Verdi got away with this stuff. He had to show his libretti to the censors, and the censors cut stuff, and he had to cut certain provocative phrases all the time. But the people understood what was not being said, and that is how he became so important.
During the lead-up to Italian unification in the late 1850s, Va Pensiero essentially became the national anthem of the Risorgimento, and Italian unification was finally achieved in 1861. By this time, Verdi was one of the most famous men in all of Italy.
Massimo D'Azeglio said, "We've made Italy, now we have to make Italians." And that is what Verdi was doing. Verdi was giving them, with his heroic and wonderful operas, a kind of surrogate national culture, which actually had existed in the past, but it was never national. There was a Florentine Renaissance, there was a Milanese Renaissance, there was a Siena Renaissance. And Dante in the Inferno, in the Divine Comedy, talks about the people he meets in hell and how they all speak their different dialects. That was a characteristic of Italy, was until really the 1980s.
Verdi was elected to Parliament immediately upon the creation of the Italian state. He served a four-year term and was even designated a senator for life. But Verdi wasn't interested in being a politician. So he happily let go of his political duties and continued writing operas. Eventually, Verdi announced his retirement from composition in the early 1870s. But there's an important postscript here. In May of 1873, the novelist Alessandro Manzoni died. Verdi had idealized Manzoni and announced that he would come out of retirement immediately and write, in his memory, a requiem.
And it's interesting that his Requiem, the famous Verdi Requiem, one of his greatest works, was dedicated to Alessandro Manzoni, the man who had revived Italian culture with the Promessi Sposi. So the circle is closed.
Verdi and Wagner were both strong nationalists. We can hear this in their music. During their time in the 19th century, the idea of nationalism was something inclusionary. It was a leftist cause. During the 20th century, nationalism became something entirely different, exclusionary, right-leaning. And this brings us to Wagner and Germany. Like Verdi, Wagner wanted to see his homeland unified as one nation, and he too put nationalistic messages in his operas, calling for a great German nation in several of them. Eventually, Germany was unified in 1871, but Wagner's music played no part in that unification. Ultimately, though, Wagner's music would become the soundtrack for Nazi Germany in the 20th century, 50 years after Wagner died in 1883. We're not going to go through the history of World War II, but we are going to examine those elements in Wagner that predisposed the German nation to adopt him as their spokesperson in the 20th century.
Bayreuth opened in 1876, and from 1876 to his death in 1883, and indeed afterwards, Wagner is, I think, by far politically the most important composer who ever lived, and his legacy can be found in the 20th century in Nazism. And you listen to Verdi the way you listen to Mozart. You do not listen to Wagner the way you listen to Mozart. Wagner did not want to be like Mozart, and by God, he wasn't.
And why not? What did Wagner do differently?
Wagner wants to intoxicate you, mystify you, and stun you. Once you are stunned, then you can be converted. Because what Wagner had in mind was to replace the existing religions, for which he had contempt, with his new religion of music and the spirit. It's a different experience to listen to it, and I do think it really is and intended to be intoxicating. And that's not true. I mean, high art of all kinds, the kind of thing you get when you listen to Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik or Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, these have deep, deep effects on us. But they aren't there to mystify and convert us to some higher way of being. And Wagner had that ambition, and I'm afraid he's pretty good at it.
And nowhere does Wagner better demonstrate that skill than in his massive Ring Cycle, the series of four operas, more than 16 hours of music altogether when performed over four nights.
And when you came out of these things, you were changed. You were converted. You had seen a new kind of faith. And I have to say, it actually happened to me. I have never forgotten the experience. I was persuaded against my will. I'm a Jewish boy from New York. We don't like Wagner. And I'll tell you in a minute why we don't like Wagner. We're absolutely justified in not liking him. Anyway, I didn't want to go. And I certainly didn't want to go to the Coliseum in London to hear the English Ring. I speak German, you know. But I was talked into it.
The first opera of the Ring Cycle is The Rheingold, completed in 1854. It's the story of the theft of gold from the Rhine River, gold which is then made into a ring of power. The second opera is Die Walküre, or The Valkyrie, completed in 1856. This is the story of Brunhilde, the heroine of the Ring Cycle, as she deals with the wishes of her father, the god Wotan. In the third opera, Siegfried, completed in 1871, we meet the youth Siegfried, who must defeat a fearsome dragon before claiming Brunhilde as his bride. The fourth and final opera, Götterdämmerung, which means Twilight of the Gods, was completed in 1872. Siegfried is corrupted and killed. Brunhilde sacrifices herself on his funeral pyre. And the gold ring of power, which has been floating through the entire story of the Ring Cycle, is returned to the Rhine River. A crucial element when listening to Wagner, and especially when listening to the Ring Cycle, is his use of something that would later come to be called leitmotifs. These are small musical ideas. An instrumental composer would call them motives or themes, but Wagner would take this to a whole new level.
He had this amazing genius of spinning out ideas, transforming them constantly in such a way that you could rhetorically follow that sense of development. It's like a great speaker starting with an assumption and then beginning to talk about that assumption and spinning out arguments and counter-arguments and conclusions, then new arguments to the conclusions, always building on what you began with, but moving into new territory constantly as the ideas spin out and develop.
And in the case of the Ring Cycle, these ideas spin out and develop over 4 days, a musical dramatic jigsaw puzzle. One drama playing out in front of our eyes, another playing out in our ears. Back to Jonathan Steinberg and the Ring Cycle he attended in London.
I found myself being swept away. And by the second or third evening of this stuff, I thought, this is amazing. I've never forgotten it. And it is, I have to tell you, it's a kind of conversion experience. And it made me really, really uncomfortable. The fact that I had sat through 16 and a half hours of this music, and even thinking about it now gives me goose pimples, completely intoxicated by this stuff. It is magical. It is magical, it's intoxicating, and it's extremely dangerous.
Dangerous? Why?
Because, in my view, it is anti-rational. It's anti-enlightenment. It's anti-liberty, equality, and fraternity. It's anti the open society. It's anti-commerce. It's really anti-commercial.
Jonathan Steinberg isn't the only one who feels this way. Here's Robert Greenberg.
Musically, superb pieces. Artistically, pieces that he's trying to sell you on something, whether you're aware of it or not. Highly politicized subject matter.
Even the philosopher Nietzsche felt there was something dangerous about Wagner.
Nietzsche was completely converted to Wagner. But in 1888, he wrote a famous essay called Der Fall Wagner, The Wagner Case. Can I read you a bit?
Certainly.
Above all, German youths understand him. The two words, infinite and meaning, were really sufficient. They induced a state of incomparable well-being in young men. It was not with his music that Wagner conquered them. It was with the idea. It is the enigmatic character of his art. It's playing hide-and-seek behind 100 symbols. It's polychromy of the ideal that leads and lures these youths to Wagner. It's Wagner's genius for shaping clouds, his whirling, hurling, twirling through the air, his everywhere and nowhere, the very same means by which Hegel formerly seduced and lured them. That is fantastic. And it was that which made Wagner so dangerous.
And so we have a composer capable of converting people, inspiring a type of fanaticism we don't see from other music. But there's another piece of this, something that Wagner wrote in 1850 that was not music.
He was in exile. He was in exile because he had taken part on the side of liberty and democracy in the revolutions of 1848-49, and he had been one of the people fighting on the barricades, rather courageously, against his former employee, the King of Saxony. Because there was a tremendous crackdown after this revolution, the secret police were everywhere, he had to flee, and he fled to Switzerland. And there he wrote this amazing essay.
Wagner's famous essay, Jewry in Music.
Which begins, according to the present constitution of this world, the Jew, in truth, is already more than emancipated. He rules, and will rule so long as money remains the power before which all our doings and our dealings lose their force. That the historical adversity of the Jews and the rapacious rawness of Christian German potentates have brought this power within the hands of Israel's son, this needs no arguments of ours to prove.
And what the Jews have done, according to Wagner, is to impose their terrible language on German and to commercialize it.
In other words, the Jew corrupts. And the Jew corrupts because he is Jewish. He is an alien commercial being, a parasite inside the body politic. This is written in 1850, anonymously, 9 years before Darwin. And it is absolutely racial anti-Semitism. And of course, this is a man who took a lot of money from Meyerbeer, who was very nice to him, the famous Jewish composer in Paris. And that's his way of thanking that. No, it's a terrible piece.
And Wagner surrounded himself with people who felt the same way. His second wife, Cosima, the daughter of Franz Liszt, was even more anti-Semitic than he was. As you might expect, there's an ongoing debate about whether anti-Semitism is in the operas themselves. But is it anti-Semitism or is it anti-capitalism? You can find people on both sides of the argument. Wagner wrote this essay just before a huge explosion of anti-Semitism in the German-speaking lands during the 1870s.
And it tells you something more that in 1869, he could publish it under his own name. And by 1880, the Prussian lower house was having a debate on whether the Jews should have their civil rights taken away. And this is the 19th century, long before the Nazis. And Wagner is part of this. And his son-in-law, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, was one of the most important social Darwinians. And Cosimo and all these people, they were thoroughgoing and outspoken anti-Semites. And their legacy was, of course, toxic.
Hitler was not alone in his conversion to Wagner, but he was the one who would take Germany into the Second World War. When Hitler was a young man making a living as a street-side painter in Vienna in the early part of the 20th century, he fell under Wagner's spell long after the composer's death.
And every penny he said, and he says this in Mein Kampf, he spent on going to the opera to listen to Wagner. Because Wagner was the secular equivalent of a religious conversion for Hitler. Wagner carries you away out of your miserable life in some crummy boarding house. You're taken into a realm of pure spirit, of pure holiness, of pure idealism, of great mythology. And he says this. He says absolutely in Mein Kampf, Wagner was the thing that kept him going, the opera. and architecture. So he belongs into the category of people whom Nietzsche was afraid would be converted. And he was.
The clock of history would tick on. The Nazi Party would come to power, and if they were looking for a strongly nationalist composer, one who also shared their anti-Semitic ideas, there would be only one true candidate. And so, Hitler would take Wagner with him as he led the German people into war, forever associating a composer of great music with one of the worst catastrophes in human history. Wagner's legacy is indeed very different from Verdi's. Nobody worries spiritually or politically about going to see La Traviata.
But it is still the case that, so far as I know, Israel does not permit performances of Wagner on Israeli soil, because the poison associated with Wagner and Wagnerianism, and also the anti-rationalism and the mysticism and the racialism and the mythology, is actually still, I think, controversial. The political issues of Beethoven's time no longer interest anybody. But what Wagner created and the legacy he left, what does Heine say? If I think about Germany at night, I can't sleep. And that is also true of Wagner. If you think about Wagner at night, you also won't be able to sleep. He still is a kind of unquiet ghost who won't let us rest. And I think that's where he is, I think, unique in a way that Verdi is not, or Mozart not. They're wonderful musicians. We love their music. We want to go to the opera and see these things. And you come out feeling good. You come out feeling humanity's okay after all. Verdi was a good, decent chap, and he gives us wonderful music and nice stories. But Wagner makes you uneasy, even now. If I were invited to go to the Ring, I have to say I would go. My wife will not speak to me, but I would go like a shot. I want to experience that again because it's so amazing. And that's the problem with Wagner. It's not like anything else, I'm afraid.
And so, when we look back, we see a dramatic difference in the history of each composer's music. Verdi's music was used during his lifetime to bring about positive change. Wagner's music was used after his lifetime with catastrophic results. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. We'll be back with more. This is The Clash of the Titans, an exploration of Verdi and Wagner. You're listening to The Clash of the Titans, an exploration of Verdi and Wagner. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. Verdi and Wagner each had standing structures built for them, buildings that are still in use today. As you might expect, these structures are very different, as the composers are different. For Verdi, there's the Casa di Riposo in Milan, and for Wagner, the Festspielhaus in Bayreuth. We're going to examine each, and in the process, learn more about the men who built them.
And the interesting thing about Verdi was that by 1860, he had become so famous, and three or four of those operas were so iconic that no opera house in the world ever goes through a year without doing at least one Il Trovatore, one La Traviata, one Rigoletto, and if they're really adventurous, maybe La Forza del Destino. It became the staple of world opera performances. Verdi was very, very famous. He himself began to doubt what he had achieved. And for quite a long time, he just withdrew from public life, and he lived in his fancy estate in St. Agata, and he created for himself the image, I'm just a simple peasant boy. In fact, that wasn't so, and I'm happy in the countryside.
As Robert Greenberg tells us, Verdi turned to other interests later in life.
He was a very private man, and we don't know a whole lot about Verdi as a result of that. I mean, he didn't write any reminiscences. He gave very few interviews. When he did give interviews, he tended to be quite taciturn. One-syllable answers were good enough for him. We do know that as he got older and as he got quite wealthy, he became a farmer, a gentleman farmer. In fact, really, that's what he wanted to do. One senses he was more interested in seed catalogs and animal husbandry than he was in the contemporary opera scene. And he was a very successful farmer as well.
Verdi's holdings as a landowner were quite substantial.
Given that Verdi invested very wisely by buying up more and more of this extremely good farmland around the village of Buzzetto, where he spent his youth, by the time he died, his estates were quite extensive. He also built a wonderful estate house called Santa Agata, as in Saint Agatha, which is now a Verdi museum. And he ran his operations the way a frugal but generous boss might run an operation. So he didn't squander any money in his lifetime either.
And Verdi's generosity and philanthropy were legendary.
For example, his longtime librettist Piave had a stroke and couldn't write any longer. And he gave him a stipend for the rest of his life. He took pity on him and supported his wife and children along with that.
I think Verdi may have been probably, in terms of his society, one of the richest composers who ever lived. I mean, he really, really made a lot of money. But what was interesting about Verdi, he did invest it in things for the common good.
He owned a lot of land by the last decades of his life, including villages in which lived the peasants who worked his land. And if you worked for Verdi, you were in good hands. You got a fair wage, you got decent working hours, bonuses, and full medical coverage, because he built and equipped and managed a hospital in a town called Villanova sul Arda, which was adjacent to his estates. In 1889, so he would have been 76 years old by then, he took his philanthropy to an entirely new level. He built a home for retired musicians and opera singers who had fallen on hard times. And near the end of his life, Verdi claimed that the creation of this Casa di Riposo per Musicisti, that is the House of Rest for Musicians, which is in Milan, was his single greatest creative accomplishment.
The Casa di Riposo is still there and still in use.
In Verdi's will, he made sure that royalties from his operas, a considerable portion of those royalties, would be diverted in perpetuum to running the institution. So it continues to run because he has allowed it to continue to run. He came up with the idea in 1889, as I said before, when he was 76. Construction began 7 years later in 1896, and it was completed 3 years after that, in 1899. The first guests were not to move in until after his death.
Verdi didn't want people thanking him. He died in 1901, 2 years after the building was completed, and the first guests arrived in 1902. And from then until now, more than 1,000 musicians have lived out their retirement at the Casa di Riposo, known simply as the Verdi House in Milan. Residents must be retirement age, 65, in order to be considered. At one time, they could house 80 residents. Now it's closer to 60. So, what made Verdi decide to build this?
The answer is simple, really. These are the people that worked for him his entire career. They're the people that shared his fate in the pit and on the stage every night. And as we all know, there's nothing quite as sad as a performing artist who performs a little bit past his or her prime, and suddenly can find no work. What money there was usually goes away. And like former athletes and former dancers, former musicians don't have a source of income once they can't practice that craft. And Verdi saw that, and he wanted to provide a home, a place, for some of the singers and musicians that needed it. And charity starts at home, and I can't imagine a better gift to give those who helped you reach your success.
If you want to visit Verdi, he's buried at the Casa di Riposo in Milan.
Verdi was a good old-fashioned liberal, and that's what the Risorgimento was about. He believed in human dignity, and he believed in free speech, and he believed in a whole lot of other things like that, and he put his money to charitable uses. Wagner wasn't interested in that. First of all, Wagner didn't have any money because it was all spent in the great project.
The great project for Wagner was the Festspielhaus at Bayreuth, a very different kind of building from the Casa di Riposo. This was an opera house that would perform only Wagner's music and perform it to his specifications.
He didn't want to be in a major city. He explicitly said he wanted to be in a beautiful solitude far away from the stench of urban civilization. so that his works could be received in a different attitude, not after a long day as a distraction and entertainment in the evening, but you would travel to that place specifically to focus all your energy on this opera, and there was nothing else.
Unlike Verdi, Wagner was not a wealthy man. In fact, we could call him financially challenged. No matter how much money Wagner had or was given, he spent it. And then he spent more, and more, and even more, and it was a serious problem. Several times in his life, he had to pack up and sneak off in the middle of the night in order to get across an international border and keep the debt collectors off his trail. But how much money does one man need, anyway?
Wagner was tremendously expensive. I mean, just think of what he's up to. He has to have his own theater. That didn't occur to Verdi. You had La Scala, you had La Fenice, you went where the theaters were. Wagner's expensive. He insisted on having his own opera house, with his own orchestra, with his own stage designers, with his own lighting technicians. They darkened, even this was the gas lights, they darkened the theater. All that, it was expensive. And he lived way beyond his means, he always had. He was always one step ahead of the debtor's prison, the whole of his life, even when he wasn't famous. He spent money like a maniac. So it's not that he wasn't popular. You couldn't get a ticket to Bayreuth, you still can't. I mean, have you ever tried to get a ticket to Bayreuth?
So how do you find someone who will build you a theater?
He published the poems of the Ring, which he wrote, with a preface. And his preface is all about this magnificent festival theater that he sees in his mind's eye. And that what's necessary is that a prince of Germany who cares about German art and cares about his German nation will find a way to underwrite this project. Now, of course, he's being a total crank. I mean, when is that actually going to really happen? I mean, does this really happen in the real world? But who reads this preface? The boy that will become King Ludwig II of Bavaria reads this preface and immediately decides, when I'm king, I'm going to be the one.
King Ludwig II of Bavaria was born in 1845, which made him 32 years younger than Wagner. He grew up a royal child, cut off from other children, a dreamer who constantly fantasized about the mythological days of Germany, just those mythological days that Wagner was busy portraying in his operas. Ludwig came to live for Wagner's prose writings and musical productions. When his father died suddenly, Ludwig, at 18 years of age, became King of Bavaria and could do whatever he wanted. And one of the first things he did was call on Richard Wagner.
Wagner had no idea what was going on until Ludwig told him, "You are my hero. You are my be-all and end-all. I'm going to make sure that all of your dreams can be realized." And Ludwig was well aware that one of those dreams was that Wagner wanted to create his own theater where he can control his own performances, basically be in charge of everything. Ludwig said, "I'm the man that's going to make this happen." Well, we should all once in our life, have someone tell us something like what Ludwig told Wagner that day in 1863. Can you imagine being given carte blanche, especially someone like Wagner? So, back to Ludwig II. Wagner could have sold him the Verrazano Bridge if he wanted to. And Ludwig had the deep pockets necessary to fund the festival hall in Bayreuth. So the foundation stone for the festival hall was laid on May 22nd, of 1872, which happened to be Wagner's 59th birthday. The building opened 4 years later, in August of 1876, for the premiere performance of The Ring.
The Bayreuth Festspielhaus holds an audience of about 2,000 and is an opera house unlike any other. And Wagner must be given credit for some significant innovations. He was the first person to darken the house. He was the first person to democratize the audience, arranging the seating so everyone had a great view. Also, very important, he was the first person to put the orchestra in a pit.
It is recessed under the stage and covered over so that it's completely invisible to the audience. Now, this was hugely important to Wagner. He didn't want any distractions in the audience's eye from what was going on the stage. He didn't want them to see the players. He didn't want to see them, the baton of the conductor. There had to be this magical connection between audience and stage. The design, because this theater is built almost entirely out of wood. In fact, it's said to be the largest freestanding timber structure in the world, this festival theater. Because it's designed entirely out of wood, it reverberates like a guitar. So by putting the orchestra actually under the stage, you're creating this amazing degree of reverberation, not just in the air, but in the building itself, which allows the voices and the instruments to blend magnificently.
If you want to visit Wagner, he's buried at Bayreuth. So, in our final contrast, we see Verdi used his own money to pay for a building to help others, while Wagner demanded others pay for a temple to himself. And this brings us to the close of our exploration of Verdi and Wagner. We find ourselves with a picture of two profoundly different sides of human nature, working within conventions to the greatest effect versus disregarding conventions and creating something totally new. Music that inspires a country towards independence versus music that gets co-opted by one of the most destructive regimes of the 20th century. The spirit of charity and generosity versus self-interest and making demands on society. Verdi and Wagner, two men unified in music but immensely different at heart. The many sides of humanity encapsulated in two titans of opera. Clash of the Titans was written and produced by Aaron Cohen. Thanks to our guests, Gundula Kreutzer, Robert Greenberg, and Jonathan Steinberg. Thanks also to Matt O'Coyne and Jeffrey Swan. Our engineers were George Wellington, Bill O'Neill, Ed Haber, and Damon Whittemore. Special thanks to Matt Abramovitz, Jenny Hauser, Ryan Lohr, and Graham Parker. We had editorial assistance from Fred Plotkin, and Demi Williams came up with our show title. We'd also like to thank Will Berger and the Metropolitan Opera, Francesco Izzo at the American Institute for Verdi Studies, Casa Verdi in Milan, the Shakespeare Society of New York, WXPN in Philadelphia, and KQED in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. Thanks for listening. This has been a special presentation of WQXR Radio in New York.